which are the norm, with confidence and effective action, because they have learned a behavioral routine for doing that, can enjoy a competitive advantage. Toyota's improvement kata is an excellent example of this second kind of routine. It tells us how to proceed, but not the content, and thus gives members of the organization an approach, a means, for handling an infinite variety of situations and being successful. We may be standing before a different way of operating our organizations, which can take us toward nearly any achievement we might envision. But to see that, we have to grasp the current situation, how we are managing our organizations today. Part 2. Know Yourself. Introduction to Part 2. One of the most difficult things to see is our presuppositions, our instincts and reflexes, and the contexts within which we operate that create them. What is our current thinking? Where does it come from? How do we tend to act as a result? What are the effects? Understanding this gives us a point of comparison, a contrast, that puts us in a better position to perceive what Toyota is doing and to be more conscious designers of how we want our organizations to function. That is the purpose of Part 2. Chapter 2. How are we approaching process improvement? As mentioned near the end of the last chapter, improvement and adaptation are critical success factors and tend to take place at the process level. How, then, are we currently trying to improve our processes? Based on observations in many factories, I currently find these main approaches: workshops, value stream mapping, and, above all, action item lists. Workshops. Improvement workshops are special improvement efforts that temporarily bring together a team of people to focus on a particular process. The duration of a workshop is typically 1 to 5 days. Workshops are used extensively and do have their place. Toyota utilizes workshops too, for example, but not as its primary means of improving and adapting. As discussed in Chapter 1, project-style improvement efforts only occur at any one process occasionally, not continuously, and involve a specially formed team. Thus, by definition, workshops are not at all the same as continuous improvement. In regard to workshops, it is also interesting to note that conducting a 1 to 5 day improvement workshop does not require any particular managerial approach. You can easily run a Kaizen workshop without having to adjust the prevailing custom. This may explain some of the popularity of workshops. Since the workshop team moves on or is disbanded after a workshop ends, we have to expect that entropy will naturally begin eroding the gains that have been made. Value stream mapping. This highly useful tool looks at the flow of material and information, and the associated lead time, across multiple processes. However, the lead time through a value stream is an outcome that is correlated with inventory, and inventory in turn is an outcome that results from performance attributes of the individual processes in the value stream. Therefore, if you want to reduce lead time, you should improve processes. As mentioned in the previous chapter, much of the mechanism of continuous improvement and adaptation takes place at individual processes. For example, applying the improvement kata at the process level, one level deeper than the value stream, is something you would do after drawing a value stream map. Value stream mapping is not intended to be a method for process improvement, but rather a method to help ensure that process-level improvement efforts fit together from process to process so that a flowing value stream is developed. Match with the organization's targets. Serve the requirements of external customers. If we try to rely on value stream mapping as a method for process improvement, then the following negative effects may arise. A value stream map can reveal so many improvement potentials at so many places that it is hard to know what needs to be done. Attacking problems here and there in the value stream, rather than focusing on and pursuing specific process-level target conditions, dilutes our improvement capacity by scattering it piecemeal across the value stream. As useful and necessary as value stream maps are, they still focus more on the surface and thus do not develop our capability to see deeply into the real situation at the processes. it is more effective to use value stream mapping for keeping an eye on the overall picture and to step into the process level with the improvement kata, as described in Part 3. What happened to suggestion systems? Enthusiasm around suggestion systems seems to have died down. I currently do not find much going on with them at manufacturing facilities. We often hear about the relatively high number of suggestions per employee and high number of implemented suggestions at Toyota, but we are not comparing apples to apples. Toyota production operators work with a team leader who follows the improvement kata. Within that framework, team leaders are also expected to actively obtain a certain number of suggestions from their team members. Furthermore, the team leader also helps team members fine-tune their suggestions via mentoring before they are submitted. This is very different from simply installing a suggestion box, so to speak, and actually has a different purpose. More on this in Chapter 7. The Action Item List. Based on my observations, the action item list is currently by far our most widely used approach for process improvement. You find managers and engineers relying on them in nearly every factory. The approach is so widespread that it needs almost no explaining, although many of us have probably not yet realized that we are using such lists as an approach. An action item list is a listing of multiple improvement ideas and action items to be implemented at a process. The lists are sometimes called open point lists and appear in various forms, such as on flip chart sheets, cards, or on whiteboards. The action items on the lists originate from recording process problems, brainstorming, problem-solving activities, waste walks, value stream mapping, and so on. Although we may believe that those uptake activities, like waste walks or problem-solving activities, constitute our improvement approach, all of them merge into the same thing, a list of action items. And it is with those lists that we actually try to manage the improvement process. In short, the list approach is done as follows. Number one, when people visit a production process, they make good point observations. We have clearly internalized what is waste, and we are able to spot plenty of problems, wastes, and opportunities for improvement. Number two, with few exceptions, we turn such observations into lists of several action items. Number three, there may be a prioritizing or ranking of items by, for example, voting or estimating benefits. Number four, action items are assigned to persons or teams, and due dates are established. Number five, the manager then focuses on who is to do what by when. Regular review meetings are scheduled, for example, on a weekly or biweekly basis, to check if people are carrying out on time the action items for which they are responsible. To convince yourself of the truth of these observations, this may be a good point to walk through your own factory. What are the results of working with the action item list approach? Number one, it doesn't work very well. The underlying thinking with the list approach appears to be that the more action items we have, the more the process will be improved. The longer the lists of action items and the more improvement projects underway, the more we feel like something positive is happening. In many cases, however, the opposite is true. There may appear to be a lot of motion, but there is little progress. Once you finish Part 3 of this book, you will be able to see that the list approach is an unscientific and ineffective method for process improvement. It is, in actuality, a scattershot approach. Multiple action items are initiated in the hope of hitting something. Although few people admit it, surprisingly little cost and quality improvement is generated via the list approach. The negligible results it produces can be observed in the lack of progress, in the wasteful and unstable processes that persist on factory floors everywhere. In many cases, the scattershot list approach creates even more, not less, variability and instability in a process. Upon closer inspection, many of the cost reductions companies talk about come from cutting resources or moving production to low-wage locations rather than truly improving the way a process operates, that is, improving how things are done. And many of the quality improvements people talk about are improvements in delivered quality, achieved by increasing inspection and sorting out more defects, rather than improving the process to reduce the number of defects created. Number two, we are in the dark. Defining and introducing several action items simultaneously, and sometimes even voting to prioritize them, indicates that we don't know what we need to do to improve. It would be better to simply stop and say, we don't yet know exactly what to do. I don't know is a completely acceptable answer and much preferable to pretending we do know, but this seems to be one of the hardest things to say. Number three, we are asking ourselves the wrong question. When we hunt for wastes or opportunities to improve and make a list of action items, we are focusing on the question, what can we do to improve? That question is actually too easy, and it automatically leads us to lists and a scattershot approach. The more focused question is, what do we need to do to improve this process? Admittedly, this is a more difficult question. Here's an example of what I mean. A large auto parts manufacturer was training four young engineers to begin work in the company's supplier development department. As part of this training, each engineer was sent to a different supplier factory to conduct an analysis and make a report. Three of the engineers returned with lists of 30 to 40 improvement ideas to implement at the factory they visited. The fourth engineer, however, returned with only 8 suggestions for improvement. The head of the supplier development department was angry with the fourth engineer, saying, "Your colleagues found 30 to 40 opportunities for improvement, and you only have 8? I think you need to go back and look again." Interestingly, the better response by the boss would have been exactly the opposite. He would say to the three engineers, "Anyone can make a long list of things we can improve and hope that something in that list will work. Please go back, look again, and tell me just the 1, 2, or 3 things that we need to do now to begin the improvement process at the supplier site." It is much more difficult to see deeply and understand what we need to do. Number 4. We are jumping to countermeasures too soon. A weakness in the list approach is a tendency to jump to countermeasures before we understand a situation. Generating a list of action items and implementing several countermeasures, often simultaneously, reflects an unspoken goal of, essentially, just shut off the problem. People are rewarded for fixing a problem, for firefighting, not for analyzing, even though the problem may recur later because it was not yet sufficiently understood. In contrast, Toyota's goal in process improvement is to learn, to develop an ever deeper understanding of the work process, and to improve the process from that basis. When you throw several countermeasures at a process, the problem sometimes does go away. This is often not because the causes have been discovered and eliminated, but because of the extra attention the process has received. Sometime later, the same problem returns, well after the improvement success was celebrated. Number 5, we are not developing our people's capabilities. The list approach does not harness or grow our problem-solving and improvement capability in a very effective manner. Why does the list approach persist? The bottom line is that we are wasting a lot of time with the action item list approach. Yet, if it is not very effective as a method for managing process improvement, why does it persist? Why do we tend to create such lists again and again? One probable reason, already mentioned, is the erroneous feeling that the more action items we have, the more improvement we have. Another reason may be that managers find it convenient to fit the list approach and regularly scheduled reviews of action item assignments into existing work schedules. For everyone involved, the list approach provides a way to feel engaged in improvement activity without having to alter their current work routines very much. The list approach also provides a way to avoid receiving blame. We can say, "I completed my action items on time," and thereby fulfill our obligations without necessarily having to generate real process improvement. The objective becomes to carry out the action items for which I am responsible, not the improvement itself. If the desired results do not come, it is not my fault, because I did what I agreed to do. It has also been suggested to me that long lists of opportunities or action items may be regarded as a reflection of how observant or smart we are. There is a more effective way to improve. Not only is the list-oriented improvement approach not very effective, it also makes improvement too complicated and difficult. To see what I mean, consider that Toyota teaches people to try to change only one thing at a time, and then to check the result against the expected result. You may work on several things simultaneously, but if possible, do not change more than one thing at any one time in a process. Such single-factor experiments are preferred because Toyota wants its people to see and understand cause and effect, which helps to develop a deeper understanding of the work processes. Studying this Toyota improvement tactic leads to some interesting discoveries. Whenever we alter any one thing in a process, we create, in effect, a new process with possibly new and different characteristics. This means that once we have implemented one or two items from an action item list, then the rest of the items on that predefined list may no longer suit the new situation and new priorities at the process. Are you beginning to see how making scattershot lists of action items is a waste of time? Multi-factor experiments, known as design of experiments, or DOE, where multiple variables are changed at once, are sometimes necessary, but only a small group of specialists is qualified to conduct them. Ideally, we want everyone in the organization involved in continuous improvement, and single-factor experiments are something that anyone can understand and carry out. If I tell you that you should, if possible, only change one thing at a time in a process, how does that make you feel? Yes, it seems way too slow. Yet we know that Toyota is improving faster than other companies. So what does this mean for our cycles in an only change one thing at a time approach? They must be fast. In other words, with Toyota's approach, we cannot wait for the next scheduled weekly or biweekly review cycle to come around. If we wait that long to check, then our progress will be too slow. By the time we do check the process, the parameters may have shifted. We should check the results of a change as soon as possible, and then, based on what we learn, consider the next steps. Unlike our current workshop and list-oriented approach to process improvement, this one does have implications for how managers, engineers, and executives slice up their workdays. Improvement is hard work, but it doesn't have to be too complicated. After studying Toyota's improvement kata in Part 3, you are likely to call a stop to and reorient any improvement effort that relies on the list approach. Instead, you will know that there is a better way to proceed and lead. Chapter 3. Philosophy and Direction. To understand Toyota's improvement kata and coaching kata, we need to consider two aspects of the context within which they operate: the business philosophy, or purpose, of the company, and its overall sense of direction. The company's business philosophy. The business philosophy of a company does much to define the thoughts and actions of everyone in the organization. However, by business philosophy, I do not mean those nice generic statements printed on the poster in the lobby. I mean, if you stood in the factory for a day and observed what people do, what is important to them, what gets measured, then what would you conclude is important to this company? As they say at Toyota, the shop floor is a reflection of management. For many manufacturers, the company philosophy or purpose would boil down to something like the statement, "Make good products for the customer." And this is not bad by any means. But consider Toyota's philosophy in comparison. Survive long-term as a company by improving and evolving how we make good products for the customer. While this sounds similar to the first philosophy, there is a significant difference. Notice the position of improvement and adaptation in each case. In the first philosophy, improvement and adaptation are an add-on, something we do when there is time or a special need. In the second philosophy, improvement and adaptation move to the center. They are what we do. Along these lines, here are a few questions to help you think about the position of improvement in your organization. Only you can answer them for yourself. Do I view improvement as legitimate work or as an add-on to my real job? Is improvement a periodic add-on project, a campaign, or the core activity? Is it acceptable in our company to work on improvement occasionally? The last question, in particular, can make things clear. Imagine you were to walk into a manager's office and say, "We made a nice improvement in process X, and then next month we will take another look at improving that process further." That would probably be acceptable. Now imagine that you said, We produced 400 pieces of product at Process X today, and next month we will take a look at producing some more product at that process. That would not be acceptable at all. And so we can see the relative position that improvement has in our company. If your business philosophy is to improve, then periodic improvement projects or Kaizen workshops are okay, but not enough. You would only be working on your organization's core objective occasionally during periodic events. At Toyota, improving and managing are one and the same. The improvement kata in Part 3 is, to a considerable degree, how Toyota manages its processes and people from day to day. In comparison, non-Toyota companies tend to see managing as a unique and separate activity. Improvement is something extra, added on to managing. Non-Toyota thinking, normal daily management plus improvement. Toyota thinking, normal daily management equals process improvement. An interesting point is that many of us would probably be afraid to focus so heavily on the second philosophy, improvement, at the expense of the first philosophy, make production. We would feel we were letting go of something we currently try very hard to control because we're accustomed to focusing on outcomes, not process details. In our current management approach, we concentrate on outcome targets and consequences. In contrast, Toyota puts considerable emphasis on how people tackle the details of a process, which is what generates the outcomes. Outcome targets, such as the desired production quantity, are of course necessary, but if you focus on continuously improving the process systematically through the improvement kata, rather than just random improvement, then the desired outcomes will come. Making the desired production quantity, for example, will happen automatically when you focus on the details of a process through correct application of the improvement kata. The following story from before the Second World War, when Toyota made weaving looms, provides an example of this way of thinking. It comes from a Toyota booklet about the spirit and ideas that created the company and relates how Kichiro Toyota, 1894 to 1952, founder of the Toyota Motor Corporation and son of Toyota Automatic Loom Works, founder Sakichi Toyota, supposedly responded when someone once stole the design plans for a loom from the Toyota Loom Works. Certainly the thieves may be able to follow the design plans and produce a loom, but we are modifying and improving our looms every day. So by the time the thieves have produced a loom from the plans they stole, we will have already advanced well beyond that point. And because they do not have the expertise gained from the failures it took to produce the original, they will waste a great deal more time than us as they move to improve their loom. We need not be concerned about what happened. We need only continue, as always, making our improvements. Does a lean value stream equal lean manufacturing? Many years ago, I visited a small automobile component factory that ostensibly operated with a lean strategy, and, in fact, the plant sported a fairly short lead time through its value stream. Its strategy involved the following elements. Hire recent high school graduates. The turnover rate was high, but the labor was young and inexpensive. Staff processes with about 40% extra operators, which was possible because of the low hourly wage. This was done so that despite problems and stoppages, each process could still produce the required quantity every day with little or no help from indirect staff or management. With extra operators in the line, the operators could dispense with problems themselves, but not eliminate the causes, and still achieve the target output. Autonomous teams, if you will. A flat organization, that is, one with few levels of management. Inventory levels were kept low since each process was generally able to produce the required quantity, which is why the lead time through the value stream was short. Only a little over 1 day of finished goods, for example, was kept on hand. The low inventory levels, flat organization, and short value stream sound lean, but here's the problem. From day to day and week to week, the same problems would arise and the operators would simply work around them. This meant that the plant was standing still, not continuously making progress or improving, and that is quite possibly what Toyota fears most of all. Honesty required. We are considering business purpose or philosophy early in this book because this is where many companies trying to copy Toyota are from the start, already on a different path. At this point, some honesty is required from you. What is the true business philosophy of your company? While we talk about the importance of providing value for the customer and continuous improvement, more than a few of us are, in truth, focused narrowly on short-term profit margin. The unspoken business philosophy at some companies is simply to produce and sell more. Or it is about exercising rank and privilege, and thus avoiding mistakes, hiding problems, and getting promoted, which become more important than performance, achievement, and continuous improvement. Direction. Having an improvement philosophy and an improvement kata is important, but not quite enough. Ideally, action would have both form, a routine or kata, and direction. For example, many of us would say that improvement, or lean, equals eliminating waste. Although this popular statement is basically correct, it is by itself too simple. The negative result of improvement equals eliminate waste thinking is twofold. We cannot discern what is important to improve, and we tend to maximize the efficiency of one area at the expense of another, shifting wastes from one to another rather than optimizing and synchronizing the whole. A classic example of this involves material handling. In the quest to eliminate waste, we often come upon the idea of presenting parts and components to production operators in small containers. The small containers reduce waste at the process because they can be placed close to the operator's fingertips, less reaching and walking to get parts, and more part varieties can be kept within the operator's reach. No changeover is necessary for producing different products. Of course, those parts currently arrive from the supplier in large containers on pallets, which are dropped off in the general vicinity of the production operators with a fork truck. At this point, a logistics manager will usually speak up and say, "Wait a minute, let me get this straight. My department is evaluated on its productivity, and you want my people to take parts out of the large containers and repack them into small containers. Then you want my people to get off the fork truck and place those containers near the operator's fingertips. And since the quantity of delivered parts will now be smaller, because fewer parts can be stored so close to the operator, my people will have to deliver several times a shift rather than only once or twice per shift. Now, we all know that lean means eliminating waste. All those extra, non-value-added activities would obviously be waste, so this cannot be the right solution." I have observed this type of debate many times, and it always goes around and around the same way. Whoever is most persuasive wins and sets the direction for a while, until someone else brings up a different persuasive argument or idea. Or we use a voting technique to make it seem that we're being systematic and scientific about choosing the direction. What in fact is happening is that the organization is essentially flailing about and frequently shifting direction as it hunts for the right solution to implement and jumps from one potential solution to another. Sometimes an external consultant will be brought in to provide a seemingly clear answer and be the tiebreaker, or to be the person to blame in case the choice does not work out. So, who is correct in this situation? The production manager who wants small containers, or the logistics manager who wants to avoid extra handling? Under the simple concept of lean equals eliminate waste, everyone is. What is missing here is a sense of direction. Although we may think of adaptation as essentially a reactive activity, it is actually what happens on the way to somewhere. Evolution in nature may not be heading in any particular predefined direction or have any particular boundaries, but for a human organization to be consciously adaptive, it helps to have a long-range vision of where we want to be. That is something we can choose or define, while the adaptation that will take place between here and there is not. By long range, I mean a vision that may extend beyond one working lifetime, perhaps even to 50 years or more. Note that a vision, or direction giver, is not simply a quantitative target. It is a broad description of a condition we would like to have achieved in the future. To repeat, the definition of continuous improvement and adaptation I'm using in this book is moving toward a desired state through an unclear territory by being sensitive to and responding to actual conditions on the ground. According to Alvin Toffler, you've got to think about big things while you're doing small things so that all the small things go in the right direction. A long-term vision or direction helps focus our thinking and doing because without it, proposals are evaluated independently instead of as part of striving toward something. Defining longer-term direction vision can be tricky and even dangerous, however. For example, although we cannot see what is coming, a vision based exclusively on current paradigms, competencies, products, or technologies can limit the future range of our adaptation too much. Toward that end, a vision should probably focus more on the customer and broad-scale customer needs than on ourselves. Visions developed in a way that seeks to protect current sacred cows are often so watered down that they are essentially useless for providing direction. An example of a useful but not overly confining long-term vision is Toyota Motor Corporation's early vision of better cars for more people. What would this vision, this direction, lead an automobile manufacturer to do? Consider Toyota's current market position, global presence, and product mix with this old vision statement in mind. Toyota's vision for its production operations. In its production operations, Toyota has, for several decades, been pursuing a long-term vision that consists of zero defects, 100% value added, one piece flow, in sequence, on demand, security for people. Toyota sees this particular ideal state condition, if it were achieved through an entire value stream, as the way of manufacturing with the highest quality at the lowest cost with the shortest lead time. In recent years, Toyota began referring to this as its true north for production. You can think of this production vision as a synchronized one-by-one flow from A to Z at the lowest possible cost, or as one contiguous flow. Note that Toyota's production vision also describes a condition, not just a financial or accounting number. What is a one-piece flow? In its ideal, one-piece flow means that parts move from one value-adding processing step directly to the next value-adding processing step and then to the customer without any waiting time or batching between those steps. For many years, we called this continuous flow production. Toyota now refers to it as one-by-one production, perhaps because many manufacturers will point to a moving production line with parts in queue between the value-adding steps and erroneously say, "We have continuous flow because everything is moving." Such a misinterpretation is more difficult to make when we use the phrase one-by-one production. Toyota's production vision, which will be the example of a vision that we use throughout this book, is actually an old concept, and it does not come from Toyota or Japan. The advantages of sequential and one-by-one flows have been known for a long time, and in one form or another, the flow ideal has been pursued on and off again for centuries. Some examples. During the mid-1500s, the Venetian arsenal developed a system for mass production of warships and could produce nearly one ship a day with standardized parts on a sequential production line basis. In the late 1700s, Oliver Evans developed a sequence of machines and conveyance devices that connected all parts of the flour milling process into one continuous system. Grain was poured in at one end of the mill and flour came out the other, without sacks of material, batches, being moved around between the processing steps inside the mill. In the 1820s, at the Springfield Armory in Massachusetts, Thomas Blanchard developed a sequence of 13 or 14 machines to process gun stocks. My colleague Gerd Ollinger takes a perhaps even more insightful and universal view on the quest to move closer to one-by-one flow, with examples such as the following. In the 19th century, if you wanted to hear Strauss play a waltz, you had to invite him to your court. Later, we would go to the store to buy records and CDs. Today, music plays on your MP3 player downloaded from the Internet. Payment for that music file is made without paper money through an automatic charge to your credit card. Prior to the 15th century, if you wanted a book, someone had to write it out by hand. Then Gutenberg began printing them. Eventually, publishing companies were born, and you could buy a book at the store during business hours. Now you order the book online anytime, and perhaps it is even downloaded to your reading device or printer. At one time we sent letters by horse rider, then came mail coaches. Following that came once daily delivery to your doorstep. Today we communicate at any time via telephone, email, and Skype. Remarkably, we still find plenty of organizations that argue internally about whether to accept this endless trend toward one-by-one flow, as if it were something we have the power to control. When I first came across Toyota's True North Vision, I thought I had caught a mistake and indicated as much to a Toyota person. 100% value added is probably not even achievable, I said. If you just move the product from one spot to the next, then there is waste. The response was, well, it could be that our production True North is theoretical and not achievable, but that does not matter. For us, it serves as a direction giver, and we do not spend any time discussing whether or not it is achievable. We do spend a lot of effort trying to move closer to it. In other words, it is acceptable and perhaps even desirable for the vision to be a seeming dilemma and thus a challenge. The Toyota person's comments reminded me of the story about two people being chased by a hungry tiger. When one of them stops to put on some running shoes, the other says, "What are you doing? Do you not see the tiger coming?" The first person replies, "Yes, I do, but as long as I'm ahead of you, I'll be fine." In a way, this is part of Toyota's strategy. Toyota is by no means perfect and is still a long way from its ideal state condition. But as long as the product is what the customer wants, whoever is ahead on the way there will essentially get the money and survive. A trick for manufacturers is to stay ahead of your competitors in this direction. The striving for improvement in this direction, in all work activity, is a guiding light in Toyota's manufacturing operations and apparently does not change. Both the company's philosophy of survival through improvement plus this direction giver have remained consistent beyond the tenure of any one leader. Toyota's progress toward this true north condition is by no means linear, but due in part to this consistent focus for over 50 years, Toyota has achieved a lead in eliminating waste and improving the flow of value, and it continues to move forward. According to Michael A. Cusimano in The Japanese Automobile Industry, as production expanded during the 1950s, Toyota shifted its priorities from improving capacity and basic manufacturing technology to developing an integrated mass production system that was as continuous as possible from forging and casting through final assembly. Vision as an overall direction giver, but not much more. Toyota's production system seeks to reduce cost and improve quality by moving ever closer to a total, synchronized, waste-free, one-by-one flow. But how do we get an organization of hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of people to work continuously and effectively in the direction of a vision? We cannot simply move from where we are today to a low-cost, synchronized, one-by-one flow from start to finish. In fact, it is dangerous to jump too far, too fast, to cut too much inventory and closely couple processes too soon. A vision is far away, and the path to it is long, unclear, and unpredictable. How do we find and stay on that path? Target conditions. Toyota moves toward a vision by working with something I call target conditions. Across the organization, Toyota people learn to set and work toward successive target conditions in the direction of whatever vision is being pursued. This condition typically represents a step closer to the vision and a challenge that goes somewhat beyond current capability. You can think of a target condition like a much shorter-term desired state that is more clearly defined than the distant vision. Like the vision, an interim target condition is also not a financial or accounting target, but a description of a condition. Once a target condition is defined, it is not optional nor easily changeable. It stands. How to achieve that target condition is optional and can tap into what humans are good at, roll-up-your-sleeves effort, resourcefulness, and creativity to achieve new levels of performance. That is, if they have a kata and are well-managed. Target conditions are a component of Toyota's improvement kata, and we will look at them closely in Chapter 5. Utilizing the sense of direction to manage people. How does Toyota utilize its production vision to help manage people? A couple of examples will clarify this. Example 1. Sensor cables. In visiting the assembly area of a factory that produces automotive ABS sensor cables, wires with a connector at one end and a sensor at the other, we found that the batch size in the assembly process was 1 week. That is, a 5-day sales quantity of one sensor cable type is produced, and then the assembly process is changed over to produce a 5-day batch of a different type. A quick calculation showed, however, that there was enough free capacity to permit more changeovers and smaller assembly batch sizes. The assembly area could set a target condition of a 1-day batch size rather than the current 5 days, and achieve that without even having to reduce the already short changeover time. In the conference room, we pointed out the potential for smaller batch sizes to the management team. The benefits of smaller lot sizes are well known and significant. Closer to one-by-one flow, less inventory and waste, faster response to different customer requirements, less hidden defects and rework, Kanban systems become workable, and so on. Almost immediately, the assembly manager responded and said, "We can't do that," and went on to explain why. "Our cable product is a component of an automobile safety system, and because of that, each time we change over to assembling a different cable, we have to fill out lot traceability paperwork. We also have to take the quality department the first new piece produced and delay production until the quality department gives us an approval. If we were to reduce the assembly lot size from 5 days to 1 day, we would increase that paperwork and those production delays by a factor of 5. Those extra non-value-added activities would be waste and would increase our cost. We know that lean means eliminate waste, so reducing the lot size is not a good idea." The plant manager concurred, and therein lies a significant difference from Toyota. A Toyota plant manager would likely say something like this to the assembly manager: "You are correct that the extra paperwork and first piece inspection requirements are obstacles to achieving a smaller lot size. Thank you for pointing that out. However, the fact that we want to reduce lot sizes is not optional nor open for discussion, because it moves us closer to our vision of a one-by-one flow. Rather than losing time discussing whether or not we should reduce the lot size, please turn your attention to those two obstacles standing in the way of our progress. Please go observe the current paperwork and inspection processes and report back what you learn. After that, I will ask you to make a proposal for how we can move to a 1-day lot size without increasing our cost." Using cost-benefit analysis in a different way. As the sensor cable example illustrates, without a direction, we tend to evaluate proposals individually on their own merits rather than as part of striving towards something. This creates that back and forth, hunting for a solution, whoever is currently most persuasive effect in the organization. Specifically, without a sense of direction, we tend to use a short-term cost-benefit analysis to decide and choose on a case-by-case basis whether or not something should be done, in which direction to head and what to do, rather than working through challenging obstacles on the way to a new level of performance. How many times have you witnessed a potentially interesting, though still unformed idea, quickly torpedoed and killed with the question, "Is there a financial benefit to that?" Toyota uses cost-benefit, CBA, analysis, too, but differently than do we. While we have learned to utilize CBA to determine what to do, at Toyota, one first determines where one wants or needs to be next, the target condition, and then cost-benefit analysis is utilized to help determine how to get there. At Toyota, CBA is used less for deciding whether something should be done and more for deciding how to do it. Traditional. CBA determines direction, that is, whether we do something or not. This proposal is too costly, then we must do something else. Toyota. CBA helps define what we need to do to achieve a predefined target condition. This proposal is too costly, then we must develop a way to do it more cheaply. Do not think, however, that Toyota's approach is about achieving target conditions at any cost. Toyota has strict budgets and target costs. The idea is to first determine where you want to go and then how to get there within financial and other constraints. This is where the sense of direction from the vision plays its role. Do not let financial calculations alone determine your direction, because then the organization becomes inward-looking rather than adaptive. It oscillates on a case-by-case basis rather than striving toward something, and it seeks to find and implement ready solutions rather than develop new smart solutions. An economic break-even point is a dependent variable, not an independent constraint that determines direction. Example 2. New production process. When a new assembly process is being designed, there are usually a few different process options from which to choose. For example, there may be a fully automated line concept, a partially automated version, as well as a manual line concept. When we run these options through a cost-benefit analysis, a return on investment, or ROI calculation, more often than not, the fully automated option wins and is what we select. Later, when the line is in place, there are complaints that the automated line does not fit well with the situation. To follow Toyota-style thinking, we would take a different approach. First, we would determine where we want to be. In this case, that means determining what type of assembly process is most appropriate for the particular situation. Fully automated, partially automated, and manual lines all have their place, depending on the situation, and all of them can be a lean line. In the early startup phase of production for a new product, the product's configuration is still apt to change, and the sales volume ramp-up may be different than expected. In this situation, it can make sense to begin with a flexible, easily altered manual line and move to higher levels of automation when the product matures and sales volume increases. Now comes the cost-benefit analysis, which, let's say, shows that the manual line design is too expensive. In the Toyota way of thinking, this does not mean that the manual line option is dropped. The target condition, a manual line, has already been defined and stands. What the negative outcome of the cost-benefit analysis tells a Toyota manager is that more work is needed on the design of the manual line in order to bring it into the target cost objective. The manager will ask his engineers to sharpen their pencils and go over the design again, and this will continue iteratively until the target condition is reached within budget constraints. The sense of direction was used to manage people, in this case the engineers who were charged with developing a new production process. Stay home. One lesson implicit in this discussion is that we should not spend too much time benchmarking what others, including Toyota, are doing. You yourself are the benchmark. Where are you now? Where do you want to be next? What obstacles are preventing you from getting there? For example, if you find that your technical support staff cannot respond quickly enough to machine problems, you might think, "I wonder how Toyota handles this." Or you could stay home and ask, "How fast do we want our technical support to respond? What is preventing that from happening? What do we need to do to achieve the desired condition?" Remember, the ability of your company to be competitive and survive lies not so much in solutions themselves, but in the capability of the people in your organization to understand a situation and develop solutions. And you don't have to be perfect, just ahead of your competitors in aspects of your product or service. Chapter 4. Origin and Effects of Our Current Management Approach. Much of our current managerial template comes out of the United States automobile industry of the 1920s, and a short, focused look back at the early history of its two giants, the Ford Motor Company and the General Motors Corporation, sheds light on our current thinking. The Ford Motor Company Approach, 1906 to 1927. In regard to pursuing the one-by-one flow ideal state, Toyota was clearly preceded by the Ford Motor Company, which undertook, arguably, Western manufacturing's last focused and sustained pursuit of the contiguous flow vision early in the 20th century. Note that I am intentionally using the word contiguous rather than continuous. Flow experiments and fabrication processes. Everyone has heard about Ford's 1913 moving conveyor final assembly line for the Model T automobile at the Highland Park, Michigan factory. But Ford's flow experiments had already begun before the Model T was introduced in 1908. In 1906, to meet expanding sales of the Model N automobile, Ford engineers began arranging machine tools for the fabrication of engine and transmission parts in the sequence of processing steps, rather than grouping them by machine type, as was then common practice. For example, if a heat treatment was required, then the heat treat oven would be located directly between the previous and next machining steps, rather than in a separate oven area. The result was considerably higher productivity. Over the next few years, Ford strove to apply this sequential processing concept to the production of many different fabricated parts. At that time, Ford's various assembly processes, engine, transmission, axle, magneto, dashboard, final assembly, and so on, were still set up as stationary tables or stands on which a whole item was assembled, typically by a single person who fit all the parts together. Even when Ford moved its parts fabrication and assembly processes to the Highland Park factory in 1910, the primary assembly approach remained stationary tables and stands. Sequential Flow Assembly Line. By 1913, the Highland Park factory still could not meet the runaway demand for the Model T. More orders were coming in than cars going out. Ford engineers, seeking ways to fill those orders, established their first sequential and moving assembly line for subassembly of the flying wheel magneto. After a few weeks of experimentation and fine-tuning, the productivity of this process was increased fourfold. You can imagine the enthusiasm with which Ford's engineers then worked to spread this sequential, flowing, and often moving conveyor-based assembly approach to the many other assembly processes at Highland Park, including the famous final vehicle assembly lines. Putting it all together. By the end of 1913, Ford had more or less the following situation in its Highland Park factory. The upstream parts-making processes, stamping, machining, etc., had been arranged in the order of processing steps for some time. The various downstream assembly processes, engine, final, etc., were now also being put into sequentially flowing line arrangements. Furthermore, there was also only one product being produced, the Model T, which meant that no changeovers were required. Except for a few different body types, all other parts on every Model T in production were the same. What would Ford's next step be in this situation? With their successes in making both fabrication and assembly processes flow, and since they were only manufacturing one product, Ford engineers tried to take flowing production to its logical conclusion. Why not connect all processes in one contiguous flow from raw material to finished product? We were not there, and we cannot interview the Model T-era Ford engineers to ask them about this, but they did leave us an exoskeleton of their thinking with the unusual, still-standing, six-story buildings at Highland Park. These buildings were added to the Highland Park factory complex in 1914, and Model T-related production took place there until 1919. The concept behind these unique buildings was that final assembly is on the ground floor and subassembly and parts fabrication processes are on the upper floors. In those days, materials were brought to factories by rail, and railroad tracks went down the center craneway of the building. In the craneway, material would be hoisted from the rail cars onto balconies that opened to the appropriate floors. At this point, I'll let Mr. Edward Gray, Ford's chief construction engineer at the time, describe the rest of the material flow in these buildings which he designed. There are thousands of holes cut through the various floors of those buildings so that the parts that started in the rough on the top floor gravitated down, possibly through chutes or possibly through conveyors or tubes, and finally became a finished article well down on the ground floor, landed on the conveyor at the ground floor. In doing some secondary research for this book, my colleague Jim Hutzinger and I became fascinated with Ford's six-story buildings at Highland Park, and this statement in particular. Once we had read Edward Gray's testimony in the Ford tax case files at the Detroit Public Library, it seemed that the assertion of Ford's Model T-era engineers striving for one contiguous flow could only be confirmed by seeing for ourselves the holes in the floors of the six-story buildings. Imagine how disappointed we were when we could not find even one hole in the floors as our Ford hosts kindly walked us through the now unused six-story buildings. Fortunately, we had an astute University of Michigan PhD student with us, Eduardo Lander, who suddenly realized these floors are 90 years old and have probably been resurfaced many times. We should be looking at the ceilings, not the floors. And as we looked up, there they were, plain as day, lots of patched holes. Ford's six-story building experiment was ultimately not a success, and the concept did not spread. we can speculate that the two cranes in each crane